The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Talking about this situation, and a man came up to me and he said, I had a neighbor who had this problem with a sprinkler system and he refused to pay it. So the fellow who installed it came over one evening and he cut the pipes up near the house or connected to the house, tied ropes around the sprinkler heads at the other end of the yard and pulled the whole thing out of the yard. That's a competitive approach to solving this problem. Let's talk about some different things. What's a worst case scenario? Not exaggerated, but is very possible to happen in a situation like this. What are some of the things that could unfold? Okay, split the church. People take sides, begin gossiping and slander. Okay, seeking leverage, trying to manipulate, put pressure on the other person through people of influence in the church, which would contribute to more division. Okay, prolonged litigation, the expense, the destruction to the Christian witness. Right. Bitterness, resentment take over, business reputations go downhill. Absolutely. What's the proverb that envy rots the bones? Something about anger and unresolved conflict actually has a physical effect, and we all know that's true. Blood pressure, ulcers, could even lead to physical violence. We had a case where a Baptist deacon beat up his elderly father over an estate problem. Beat him to the ground. So physical violence could break out. We wrote out a scenario one time that incorporates a lot of this and all these problems that develop, and it goes into litigation, and pretty soon Jim is losing business. He's suffering that loss. Meanwhile, the fellow had this system installed, is getting more anxious. He's filed a lawsuit, and he's spending part of his time going around trying to find other sprinkler men to testify against Jim as expert witnesses. He's so distracted by this, he's not concentrating at the office on his work. Evaluation comes up, and his supervisor says, boy, you don't seem to be here these days, so that raise we're going to give you is going to be passed over. So there's the money he needs to pay for the lawyers to carry out the lawsuit, and he's not going to get the raise. Meanwhile, Jim's business is going downhill, cash flow problems, and he resorts back to drinking as he did 3 years ago. His wife remembers 12 years of that, and she packs up the kids and moves out. Jim digs in his heels, refuses to deal with the problem. 3 months later, he's served with divorce papers, and all the while, the lawn continues to turn brown. That's a scenario that is not uncommon. And that's what's so sad about conflict, is the process starts as like dominoes falling over. It just goes and goes, and pretty soon there's all sorts of people being affected because we didn't have resolved things in the first place. How would following the Matthew 18 process prevent some of these problems? Obviously, it could, but be specific. What would Matthew 18 do specifically if it's applied properly? Good. And it wouldn't have to involve other people necessarily. Just taking that first step, go and talk in private. And let's face it, as human beings, most of us have a certain degree of pride and concerned about what other people think of us. Once you involve other people, it's harder to back off from a position you took earlier, because now you have to explain to all those people you already talked to why you gave in. And the more people you involve, the more entrenched you become. So in using Matthew 18, keeping things private and personal gives you more flexibility and does not involve these other dynamics, doesn't build up this momentum. So the gossip, slander, the church division, a lot of those things are eliminated. What else could happen with Matthew 18? Okay, both sides could see their own responsibility and have some constructive change. They could both learn some things to do differently in the future. The process remedial, not competitive. It's not to win the money or the process, but to learn and see how to grow. There's another comment back there. Careful inspection or investigation to understand might reveal that the problem really is not the leaking sprinklers and the inadequate heads. There may be other more serious problems that are of much more consequence in Jim's life that are preventing him from doing this job adequately. And by going and trying to understand, you may find ministry opportunities there. It's not unusual in these situations to find business problems having the roots in spiritual difficulties, family problems at home. I'll never forget the story about a woman who was going through a checkout stand, and the clerk was having a lot of difficulties, making mistakes, and several people were critical of her. And this one woman, as she came through, was watching this and was getting more and more concerned. So when she got up there, she could see the clerk was just about in tears, and she was fumbling and making a lot of mistakes, but this woman just said something kind to her and said, "Just relax, it's not all that bad, it's okay." And the clerk burst into tears and said, "Thank you so much for being kind. My father just died this morning, and I'm trying to get a plane to fly out to see him." So here's someone with this deep problem that nobody was sensitive to, and picking away at her on these other things were superficial. That happens more often than we realize. So taking a more personal approach can allow us to minister to somebody and really reach out to them in a godly way. The other things that can flow from this, of course, is children can learn from this. There's been situations where when I've learned that the children in a family know, when they know about a particular conflict their parents are involved in, if they already have a lot of information, and the cat's out of the bag, is involve them in the solution. And sit down and say, "Hey kids, we're going to sit down tonight, and we're going to talk about this problem we've had with our neighbor or someone at work, and you've heard a lot of negative things we've said, and I've realized that wasn't the right way to do it. And so I'd like to have your help now in figuring out a good way to resolve this." And so getting out the Bible passages and talking about these principles, involve the children in that. What a lesson to see their parents humbling themselves, admitting they're wrong, and then getting back on track. So that's a way to serve other people, to minister to your kids. One of the saddest things that I ever see in my work as a mediator is an older person sitting in my office crying because the children, it might be a woman whose son is going through a divorce, and that person is sitting there saying, "I know that I failed to teach things to him when he was young, and now my grandchildren are suffering because of his irresponsibility or his temper or his anger. And there's a sense of responsibility that I could have done more. And I'd like to see people spared from that grief." Now, we're not responsible for what our children do, but we are responsible for the things that we try to teach them to do the best job we can. So teaching things to kids now today can save them and us from grief down the road. Okay, looking at the next question, what kind of advice would, let's say the person who installed the sprinkler system, instead of having it in the first person, let's say that it's, let's call him Bill. Let's say Bill is the one who installed it, and Jim's the one who's installed it, is doing the work. What kind of advice would Bill probably receive from other people on how to deal with this problem? Non-Christian people who've never been to a peacemaker seminar. Sue him. Yeah, sue him. Okay, give some of the rationale. What are some of the other phrases or jargon that you would hear? "You have your rights." Boy, isn't that a popular phrase. We worship rights in this country. What else? "You had a contract. Enforce the contract. Go to the Better Business Bureau, report him, put some pressure on him. You know, if he's going to be that way, well, we'll get back at him." It wouldn't, pardon me? Justice needs to be done. I often hear that. You know, "I'd like to let it go, but, you know, it wouldn't be just to let him do that." Where would we be if God was rigidly just? Oh, I thank God that he is merciful, that he tempers that justice and applies it with a merciful spirit. I think we would also get the idea, well, it wouldn't be right to let him get away with this. He's probably doing it to other people. Now, yes, that may be true, and there may be a need to confront him, but not to make an object lesson of him, but to minister to him, to help him, if this is a pattern in his business, that he could overcome it and do things more responsibly. So we can say the same words, but have entirely different motives, can't we, in a situation like this? Another thing, if you were talking to a friend, said, "Well, you know, part of me just feels like I ought to just drop this thing. It's not that big a deal. I can probably get it fixed myself and, you know, work something out." What would be the response that you might get if that was what you were going to do? "You're crazy. Don't let people push you around. You're a fool. You're weak. A doormat." Boy, is that a common phrase. Yeah. And that's the pressure that a lot of people come under. It's that fear of man that just pressures us and pushes us down a road that many of us really don't want to go down. So we need to be aware that there is that worldly influence. Okay, why would God be concerned about this particular situation? Dividing brothers in the church, potentially dividing a particular congregation. Satan loves that. Therefore, God is concerned about it. Why else? Sure. And there's a kind, that's a good analogy to use. We're his children. And when and just as in, as we are concerned about our children, and we have sometimes a couple of different motives. One of them is, you know, what will people think of us if they see our kids doing this? And God has that attitude, but in a righteous way, because we are his ambassadors, officially appointed to be ambassadors here. So when we misbehave like that, it does dishonor God. In Romans 2, Paul rebukes the Jews in the community in Rome, and he says, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of your disobedience. So there is a concern for reputation. But there's another side of the coin that as a parent, if I saw my daughter involved in a conflict, just my heart, my concern, my compassion for her, I don't want to see her hurt. I don't want to see her do things that would hurt other people because I know ultimately that will hurt her. So God's fatherly love would also be triggered in a situation like this. The witness, the unity, all those things in the church, yes. You bet. Someone has made some steps toward a solution, and we should be sensitive to that and encourage that and use that as an opportunity to witness. You know, there's a lot of people watching this conflict. There's all the workers. I mean, there's Jim and there's Bill. And then there's a bunch of workers. And then most of those people are probably married. And they go home and talk to their spouse. And then there's the children. And then there's people in the churches, all these people watching, some of whom do not know the Lord. Tremendous witnessing opportunities for good or for bad in a case like this. And we just don't see that sometimes. We miss that dimension. So God has quite a few interests here to reach out to minister. If he arranges and allows a situation like this to come to pass, there's an opportunity in it that we should be careful not to miss. Now, this gets a little more specific. What has Bill done that is wrong in this situation? What logs does he need to get out of his own life, his own eye? Okay, accusations, slander. There's no indication that Jim was intent on cheating him. They have a disagreement at this point, but not a deliberate desire to cheat. What else? Yeah, he did not pause. He did not pause and take his time to negotiate in a godly way. He just jumped to conclusions. And that would to some degree violate one of the most basic principles. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I don't like to be backed into a corner and be given ultimatums. And he violated that principle because I'm sure he wouldn't want to have that done to him. Even earlier, though, back when the whole thing began, what were some things he did that were? That's a good point. He might actually be part of more of the problem than he realizes. Again, it would be a violation of a basic principle. Do to others what you have them do to you. It's a good question to ask yourself in a conflict. Would I have wanted someone else to be hanging over my shoulder critiquing my work? I put in a sprinkler system a couple years ago, and I know that there are hundreds of parts involved, and when you first put it together, it's inevitable there's going to be a few leaks and some adjustments. Some professionals know that. They don't put all the dirt back in until they've turned it on and tested it and all that. So there was a lot of disrespect here, discourtesy, and assuming some wrong things about people and not treating them the way you would want to be treated yourself. Anything else that Bill has done? Yes. It's a subjective evaluation, and we're not real specific on the facts here. It's a question of how many mistakes were they? Were they preliminary things that probably would have been remedied in the course of the construction? Because there is a process of putting these things in, again, where there are going to be some things and some adjustments that are made. In this particular, in the real life scenario, all the problems that came up were not unreasonable, defective type things. They were things that would have been eventually put together as they worked through the system and got it all together. Now, again, if it was a gross situation, gross problems that were going to be hard to remedy, that'd be another thing. But under this scenario, it was really he was jumping the gun and getting too picky too soon. Yes? Absolutely. They got caught in the middle. That's a very awkward spot for a worker to be in. And they're supposed to defend their boss, and yet they're working there, and they're trying to appease this customer, and that's not helpful. So disrespecting that chain of command. Yeah, a lack of trust. And I don't like it when people don't trust me. That offends me. That troubles me. Now, if there's a basis for it, I need to be confronted on it. But if it's just sort of a natural suspicion, that's troubling. Talking to other people about it, you know, talking to people in church who have no legitimate interest in solving this thing, no ability to be involved, it's just part of a gossip chain. So that was inappropriate. Anything else you can think of that Bill needs to take responsibility for? Yes. What could be done at this point? What are some possible solutions? Sure, to be sensitive. I mean, here's an opportunity to start rebuilding, to give a favorable response, to be sensitive. And who knows what that workman thinks when he makes that attempt and is sort of just brushed aside. So being sensitive to those things is very important. Okay, what about some solutions? If Bill came to you and described the situation to you and says, you know, I really got myself into a mess and I don't know what to do, what advice would you give to Bill? Okay, to negotiate on what it would cost and even be willing to make some concessions on it to split some difference. There's a lot of factors that would go into that, how much you would do. Let's come back to that one in a minute because I want to spend some more time on that. But are there some other things that might be appropriate at this point? Okay, let's imagine we're going to do that. You decide that you need to talk to Jim. How would you arrange that? Call him up on the telephone. Okay, what would you do in the telephone conversation? Okay. Pardon me? Arrange it. Okay. What would you do? Ding-a-ling-a-ling. Hello, this is Jim. What else might you add to that statement that might be even more helpful? The words I just want to caution you, be careful about, because people read into them so quickly. We need to get together can be interpreted as a demand, or I want to get together can be interpreted as a demand, that you're forcing something on them. And I want to strongly emphasize to you, choosing those words carefully is to say, Jim, I feel very badly about what happened at the house the other day. I know I was wrong to say those things, and I would like to be reconciled. Would you have some time to get together this afternoon? Could I come by your office at your convenience? I cannot emphasize to you strongly enough the importance of using those kinds of words in that telephone conversation, asking rather than demanding. Again, remember, it's not good enough to communicate so you can be understood. You must communicate so clearly you cannot be misunderstood. It's very important. Okay, so you call me up and you ask for a meeting and we sit down. What do you say? What are some of the first things you would say to me? Good point. It's right off the bat to make it clear and just say, Jim, I need to clarify something before we go any further. I know you are a good businessman. I know I said some things that have drawn that into question, and I need to retract those things right off the bat. Really clearly setting the stage early in the conversation for that. If you sincerely believe it. If you've got some questions about it, don't say it. But if you sincerely believe he is good, make that clear. Yes. Good. Just develop common ground on your faith. Now, that's where you've got to be sensitive. It depends a lot on where Jim is coming from. If you know him well, if you know him to be a man who is sincere in his faith and is willing to talk about it and his relationship with the Lord, you could build that common ground earlier. If you're not sure where he is on that, maybe he's just been hanging on the fringe of the church for a long time. Of course, there's a lot of people that attend church that really don't know God. They're religious, but they're not in the family. And so you've got to be sensitive to that. But as you get a feeling for where they're at, trying to build that common bond is very important. One way you could do that is to start off by saying, well, in fact, the first thing I would say in that meeting is I would thank him for coming. I'd say, I really appreciate you being willing to meet this afternoon. I know you've got lots of things to do, and I appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with me. That'd be probably about the first thing out of my mouth. The other thing I would say is that, Jim, I need to tell you, you know, the main reason I want to meet is to make things right between us. I would make it clear that my agenda is not to have a further debate and argument. So I get it expressly stated early on is that I want to resolve this thing. Might even put into that early conversation some personal transparency and say, I need to be honest with you. A few days ago when this all happened, I was angry, but God has been working in my heart the last few days, and last night as I was laying in bed, it became really apparent to me that I was flat wrong, and I've done some things that were very inappropriate and very wrong in talking with you. So you might begin to share a little bit from your own heart what's going on, what God's doing with you, if you deem it appropriate with that person. You have to be sensitive to read that. Okay, what else might you say in that conversation? Okay, give him the check for the $200 for the work he has actually completed. Let him know that you're not going to hold that back as leverage. Now, that may be a very good idea in some cases. Depending on the facts, it may not be appropriate. But I think if I was going to err in the direction, I'd rather give him the money than not give him and later regret it. So that'd be a very goodwill, an appropriate goodwill gesture right off the bat to have that check right there with you and say, first thing I want to do is pay you for what you've done because that system is in. I know there's some fine-tuning we need to do, but I have every confidence that you're going to do it, so I have no problem giving this to you. Demonstrating good faith in somebody. There was a hand over here. Yes. I would do it. It depend a little bit on Jim. If I knew him to be a man who was comfortable with that, I would say, before we begin, Jim, could we take a minute to pray and ask God to help us? If I did not know he was comfortable with that, I would probably hold off for a while. I'd be praying all the way over there, and even as we're talking, I'd be praying to myself, but I wouldn't want to put too much pressure on him right off, because people can misread that too easily. But that's a very good point to bring up. Prayer would be essential. Okay? What should come before asking forgiveness?
Confession.
Specific confession. And one of the things that it's a little bit like getting a wound and it closes up too early and it heals on the outside but it's still festering on the inside. I heard someone say recently I had to reopen a wound and let it drain out because there was still infection in there. If you don't give a thorough confession and demonstrate and articulate your repentance and you jump too quickly to asking for forgiveness, you can put pressure on someone who's a Christian to prematurely forgive you, and they'll say it, but they'll walk away and they'll feel they haven't really dealt with the issues. This happened to Corletta me one time. We were at a CCS conference, and right after we got married, and I said something in front of some other people. I was teasing her, but it hurt her feelings. And a few minutes later, she told me that in our room, and I gave her a quick mechanical confession. I said, "Will you forgive me?" And she said, "Yes, I will." And I, zipped back out in the other room, and I had not given her really time to talk about it and to work it through. And later on, she had to pull me aside and said, "Ken, I know I said I forgive you, and I promised not to bring it up again, but I need to ask you, could we talk about it for a few minutes? There's something I don't think you understand on why that hurt me so much." And I said, "By all means." And she explained some things I did not understand. I was grateful she did it. So we need to be careful not to prematurely jump to that conclusion, but to make sure that we've allowed that whole process using those seven A's. Admitting specifically, apologizing, accepting responsibility. And I use, even in mediation, one of the hardest things I have to do is working through the confession and the storytelling and all those things, and people are wanting to jump to forgiveness. I say, "I appreciate your spirit and your willingness, but I'd like to ask you to hold off on that until we get all these issues out and talk about them, because forgiveness means we're not going to bring these things up again. And so let's not make that commitment until we're all satisfied it's been adequately discussed." So I will sometimes hold off the granting of forgiveness for 2 or 3 days. I'll commend people for their desire to forgive and their willingness and all that, but I'll say, let's not make those final promises until this is all dealt with. So that's just one helpful insight to you. What else might you say in this conversation? We're talking about admitting specifically the things that that Bill did. He would talk about the disrespect, the lack of courtesy, the lack of trust, the slander. What other things might he say as part of his confession to make it adequate, to make it persuasive? Absolutely. And you know what will make that especially hard is if Bill doesn't know whether or not Jim knows that he slandered him. You know, what he doesn't know, maybe I don't need to bring up. And that's a touchy issue. And the way I generally handle that is that it's distinguishing between what you might call private sins and social sins, or heart sins and social sins. If I sin against somebody just in my heart, maybe someone says something to me that hurts my feelings, and I entertain some bitterness and resentment for a few days, but I don't see the person during that period, there's no opportunity to communicate those sentiments to him, and by the time I see the person again, I've worked it through. I do not think it's appropriate or helpful to go up to that person at that point and say, "By the way, I just thought you should know that I've been hating your guts for the last few days." I don't think that's at all profitable. I think I should confess it to God, because those offenses are an offense against God. But if it's something you've worked through and has not impacted another person, and it's just a heart sin, I think that can be dealt with privately. But if my actions have actually impacted somebody else, or if there's any room for doubt in my own mind I have seen that individual, and she may have gotten the impression I was giving her the cold shoulder, she's probably wondering what's going on. If there's some doubt, then you would need to go and say, "Yes, there has been bitterness, and I'm sure you've sensed a coldness on my part, and I need to ask your forgiveness." So going and confessing those things would be appropriate. What else might you have as part of your confession? Absolutely. We're going to talk at the end of this on how we can deal. In fact, let's jump ahead to the end. Let's assume these two men do get reconciled. They do work out their business differences. How might you deal with that particular problem? All these other people somehow got wrapped up in it, because it may not be good enough to go and talk to the 4 or 5 people you've talked with, because by the time you get back to them, guess what? They've talked to some other people. So it's hard. Once the cat's out of the bag, it's sometimes hard to get back in. How might you remedy that problem? A testimony before the church. We had a situation in our church where there was a business deal that went sour, and there's some real offense taken. and possibly the loss of quite a bit of money. And the church elders got involved for several days and helped work out a settlement on it. And a lot of people in the church knew there had been some very hard feelings and had been affected by it, had taken sides. And so as part of the reconciliation process, we agreed it would be appropriate for those two people to stand up and give a testimony. And they had been sincerely reconciled. And so when they stood up, they were able to stand up there and say, a lot of you know what's gone on and what's happened, and we just want to give glory to God that he has helped us to work it through. And the one person said, I had to admit and recognize that some of my business practices are not as they should be, and I'm making these changes. And the other person acknowledged some things that he would do. And it was a real testimony to the people in that body. Now, I wouldn't do that lightly. I don't like to open things up unnecessarily, but sometimes that's the only way to really get the word out. What else might either one of these men do to facilitate a solution here? Yes. Who is really at fault for this thing? Okay. One of the workmen made a mistake on measuring the water pressure, so it was his error. Who ultimately has to bear responsibility for that? Jim does, really. Jim is the contractor. These people are accountable to him. It's the old adage, the buck stops here. Now, Jim may need to deal with that worker to admonish him and say, in the future, be more careful, and here's how you work the instrument and all of that. But ultimately, Jim is the one that Bill made the contract with. Now, I think you could bring that person in as part of this process. I think there'd be some constructive ways to do that, to reassure him, to indicate even, you know, your forgiveness for him, etc. Although I don't know that forgiveness is really the right term. It wasn't a moral thing. It was an error in judgment. But bringing that person in might be appropriate, but ultimately Jim has to take responsibility for this. Now, what else might be? Either you could go to somebody who does not know about it and seek counsel and not identify who the person is or any identifying facts. You know, it doesn't do any good to say, we'll call him Jim No Name or No Name Smith. You know, there's a lot of things people do to give away identity, so you've got to be careful not to do that. But in a case like this where people in the church already know about it, I'd say the best place I would turn would be to an elder in the church if I needed advice, who already knows. I mean, there's already rumors floating around, so let's get someone with some spiritual maturity and wisdom involved who can immediately step in and help us work on it. When we encounter a case that's in a single church, both parties, we very early try to get the church leadership involved to take responsibility for that solution. Now, again, the concept is certainly true. You're saying is keep it as small as possible, don't involve people unnecessarily, but if there's already some word that's out in the church, getting those elders involved might be appropriate. Is there anything else you can think of in terms of a solution that might facilitate a godly solution? Yes. To build each other up and encourage each other. Very much. Yes, Charles. The question there would be, what I would ask myself is, if the bid was $100 higher because the measurements were made accurately and his bid included those more expensive heads, would I have given him the contract anyway? And if I would have, then I would say it's not right for me to have unjust enrichment because of his mistake. So I personally would offer him that. Now, at the same time, if I was Jim, and this is the interesting thing about these conflicts, that if each person looks at his own responsibility, you come to different solutions sometimes. If I was Jim, I would say, I signed a contract saying I put in a system that worked for this amount of money. Now, one of my workmen made some mistakes. Ultimately, I have to bear the responsibility, so I offer to complete the system and bear the extra cost. And then Bill says, I appreciate that, but in fact, I would have paid the higher money anyway if you'd done it, so I'd be willing to pay the $100. No, I'd rather pay the $100. No, I'd rather pay the $100. Meanwhile, the workmen are sitting out there saying, this is incredible. I've never seen people do this before. That's how these things should end, is with a fight as to who's going to take more responsibility. And finally say, okay, let's both kick in $50. That's a solution that leaves people with what Paul says in Philippians, a peace that transcends understanding. This doesn't make sense to people, that they're solving it like this. And this is what is so significant about Christian peacemaking, is that if each person looks at their own responsibility, you very often come up with a solution regardless of what the other person does. You say, here's what I will do to solve it no matter what you do. I'll put in the system, I'll bear the cost. You know, I'll pay for it. You finish the system. Is there anything else that you can think of that might be a way to cement a solution in this situation? I think both sides should look first to their contract. And if there is a contract, they need to abide by the terms of it. And unfortunately, what happens, sometimes the contracts don't anticipate all these contingencies. But if the contract in this case, as you said, says that there may be some additional cost depending on what we find out as we get into the system, then the owner should pay those things. Of course, I'm always reluctant to sign something like that because you don't know what's going to happen. but definitely the people should pay attention to what that agreement was. No question about it. Another thing that I might offer to do in this case, it's a way of sealing that solution. It's sort of like a wax seal on an envelope. How do we bring this together and tie it together? One thing I would consider doing if I was Bill is to say, Jim, even though we had these difficulties that came up, I appreciate the way you handled them. And that even though we had some misunderstandings, I know there's this other pressure, but ultimately you came to me, you took responsibility, the system worked very well. I'd be very happy to recommend you to other people. If you want me to write out a letter of recommendation or even give my name out for people to call me, I'd be very happy to do that. That's a way of bringing this thing back together again, what was said earlier, to affirm your confidence in someone's professional ability. People will generally live up to or down to our expectations of them. If you believe in somebody and affirm what's positive in them, most people will strive to live up to that. If you think someone's a loser or will never do anything good, don't be surprised if they're a loser and never do anything good. It's just a common feature of human relationships. Okay, that's just a few practical things in a situation like this, some thoughts to think about on how to deal with something. Let's look at the next problem, the pizza problem. This is a fairly simple one. Take a moment to read it. Okay, some retaliation because they didn't give him the room. Okay, that's a good point. There might have been some smoldering resentment there that he was a little bit frustrated with them about. Yeah. You said I'll take 11 pizzas. I agree. I agree. You know, we live in a culture today that is so intolerant of other people's mistakes. It just scares me what's going on. The medical malpractice, the pastoral malpractice, the counseling malpractice. Now, granted, there is a place for tort actions and negligence actions when somebody has a pattern of being careless and irresponsible, and there's a place to hold them responsible. But the question I begin to ask people in these cases is, would you want to live the rest of your life living up to the standard you want to impose on this person? We've got a terrible problem in Montana. A lot of doctors are leaving the practice of medicine because it has become so hostile. And I've got a lot of friends who are doctors. There are so many situations that come up that are close calls in terms of treatment and things they do. And if you make the wrong decision and someone suffers for it, immediately there's this $1 million lawsuit filed. Now again, there are cases of negligence that need to be dealt with, but I'm quite confident that most people that file those actions would not want to live to that kind of perfection the rest of their life. Getting up in the morning involves some risks. And I think we need to be tolerant. And so the mistake in this case of double booking, I've made worse mistakes than that in my life, and I appreciate people overlooking them. So you're right. I think that's an inadvertent mistake that is not significant. And if it triggered vindictiveness or vengeance in Jack, that was wrong. But he did make the verbal contract for the 11 pizzas. Now, when this manager said either take them or none at all, and Jack thought that that meant that he was going to buy them himself, what was Jack doing at that point? Conveniently interpreting something, you know, trying to, there was some reason for doubt, so he just conveniently interpreted. No, he didn't say that. He just said, oh, I'm sorry, you're right. He said he would buy them himself. Okay. Okay, that you're right. I'm glad you pointed that out. So let's take it at that point. Jack comes to you, he relates those facts to you, says, well, he just said he'd buy them himself, so I'm off the hook. What would your counsel to Jack be? Well, arguably it would. You could say that he voluntarily amended the agreement, and you might argue about walking away from it. But Jack, you know, think about it. You go in there, he's busy, it's late at night, you do this to him, you've got 11 pizzas sitting there in boxes, and he's frustrated, and he says, okay, I'll just buy myself. You know, is it really reasonable to hold that against him? Would you want someone to hold that against you? I wouldn't. I'd say, Jack, I think that there's an opportunity to witness here. There's an opportunity to explain, to go back and say, even though you said you'd buy them yourself, I realize it's not reasonable for me to hold you accountable to that, and I need to pay for those pizzas, and here's a check. If I'm going to err, I would rather err in that direction. One of the most helpful things that I've heard that has been a source of guidance to me, it's helpful to do everything you possibly can do to resolve it so that you would never meet somebody on the street who could look you in the eye and say you didn't do everything you could to resolve that. I want to be able to walk down the streets of my community and look anybody in the eye, and even if it's someone who's estranged from me, where I in good conscience can say I left no stone unturned to make things right with you. especially since the fact is I'm an ambassador. You know, the ambassador to Great Britain has a higher standard of conduct than the average American tourist. The ambassador is not supposed to go out and do a lot of things that a tourist may be able to do, because the ambassador is there as a representative. And that's what we are. And so some things that you might argue, well, I can get away with it, he said this, he said that. When you think about your ambassadorial responsibility, you say, no, I don't want to leave any room for doubt or someone to criticize. So I would recommend that he go back, pay for those pizzas. Now, let's assume that your friend is the pizza parlor manager and he comes to you and tells you this. What would your advice to him be? If he told you that in anger he said, well, I said I'd buy him myself, what would you say? You gave your word, you said that, you better just do it. And see, that's interesting. Both sides have responsibilities that are somewhat different that can resolve the dispute. That happens so often. Yeah. And it's such a good point that once you break the discussion and even let a few hours go, much less a few days, it's harder to go back and pick up where you left off. It's harder to go back and confess, because now you not only have to admit you were wrong, but you were wrong to be wrong this long, and you should have dealt with it earlier. And it gets harder and harder and harder to make confession. So dealing with things early is very important. Yes, Ron?
In an earlier session, you said you'd work with you.
Absolutely. And that's a very good point, is if someone comes to you for advice, it's usually much more helpful to ask questions to begin with, to help lead them in their own thinking, their own analysis, to look at things from a perspective they might not be doing naturally, get them to think about things a little bit differently and come to their own solutions. And only as a last resort, in fact, very often when people come into me, they give me a scenario and they say, what should I do? And I'll resist, I'll say, well, I don't think it would be helpful for me just to tell you what to do. Let me ask you some questions. I'd like to think this through with you. And if they come to the end of it and they come up with their own solution, when they walk out, they're much happier with it. Now, I'm not endorsing Rogerian psychology where that's all you do and you never give advice, like that's dangerous. There is a time to give directive counsel, but I prefer to do that later in the process if at all possible. What else might Jim or Jack do to sew this situation up? He goes and he pays the pizza manager, and in fact, there's a scenario so close to this that happened after this case. A close friend of mine ordered some lumber to build a desk, and he somehow got another desk, so he didn't need the lumber, and it had to be special ordered, so he called the place to cancel the order. They said, no, it's already ordered, it's already here. And he said, well, I already got a desk, so I don't need it. Can't you sell it to someone else? He said, well, we could, but you ordered it, so you really ought to pay, but there's no written contract. And so this fella, I forget exactly the reasoning, but he said, no, I don't think I will. And they hung up with a few harsh words. And within minutes, my friend was convicted. He knew that just simply wasn't right. And so he called the fellow back up and he said, I'm sorry, I need to apologize. That was not right of me. You did order the stuff in. It was very gracious. And the guy on the other end of the phone said, well, you know, I got off the line. I was angry at first, but now that you've called back, you're right, I can sell the stuff, so no big deal. But why don't you drop by sometime and I'll buy you a Coke. Literally, that's what he said. And he just gave him this. So again, it's the adage of people treating us how we treat them. What I would do to sew this situation up, if I was a Little League team manager, one of the best reasons I can think of to coach a Little League team is to be giving a witness to those kids. And you want to do it in a gracious way and not presume on them and everything else, but is to get the kids together and say, hey, I need to tell you a story. You know, last week when we had that pizza parlor, something happened, and here's what I did. And there's ways to even share with the kids some lessons in those things that could have a dramatic effect on them. So be sensitive to those issues and be asking, Lord, how can I minister? How can I teach? How can I encourage? Don't let those opportunities slip through your fingers. And just one final thing, a story that more recently relates to this, and I'm sort of embarrassed to tell this one, but the point I think is worth it. I recently had some work done on my house, and the work was very poorly done, and the poorest workmanship I've seen in a long time. And I was frustrated. I called the place and asked them to come and correct it. They didn't do anything. I finally wrote them a letter, and it was a pretty stern letter, much more aggressive than I normally write, but it was very direct. Still didn't get a response, so I went down to this place to go in and confront the manager. And I'm normally fairly gracious, I think, in confrontation, but that day I was just owly. And I went in there, and I started talking to him about getting this work done. He was defensive toward me. I saw some customers walk in the door, and there is so much wickedness in my heart still. Because the first thing I thought was, okay, now I've really got some pressure on him. He's got some potential clients here. And so I started talking a little bit louder. I said, well, listen, if you can't do good work and stand behind it, then I don't think I would recommend anyone else to come and get work with you again. Well, he was furious, and I can understand why, standing in his own front office. And he got very angry and just said, well, we'll come and fix it, and we'll give you all your money back. He just got so angry. I said, fine, and I walked out. I was walking around the side of the building, and I came under such conviction. I mean, instantly I knew I was so wrong. And the fear came to me, and all the other thing compounded is I walked out, I saw some little scripture tracts in the rack in the front room. So this guy is supposed to be a believer, and I'm supposed to be a believer, and we're acting this terrible way. And I walked around the back parking lot, and I just knew I could not leave this thing. And as someone said, if I left then, it'd be even harder to come back the next day. I said, I've got to go back and deal this now. And my fear was that I was going to eventually be speaking in some church in Billings, and he would be out in the audience. And I knew that would just embarrass me. So as I went around back and I was just saying, Lord, help me, please. I've done something terrible. Help me get out of it. Well, in the meantime, he came out in the back of his business to get something out of a truck, and I saw him going into the back door. And so I just turned my steps and went over there and prayed a little prayer as I went in and said, listen, I need to talk with you. He said, what about? I said, I need to apologize. I was wrong. I'm sorry for saying those things. And I was practically in tears. I felt so bad. And he was so nice. He said, well, I know we didn't do the work we should have, and you weren't out of line. I should have. He just fell all over himself apologizing. It all happened in 30 seconds. It was that quick. And sure, that was about 18 months ago. He was sitting in my church 2 weeks ago. And I was leading the worship service. And I was so, a friend had invited him to come and visit our church, and I was so thankful that God helped me to work that thing out. You never know when you're going to meet someone down the road. Okay, here's one of my favorite stories. Let's, the shed. This is sort of a fun one. This is one of my very first conciliation cases 10 years ago. Right or appropriate for Bob to file a lawsuit to force Joe to live up to his agreement? Okay, I hope you all say no to that. 1 Corinthians 6, if any of you has a dispute with another, how dare he take it before the ungodly instead of before the believers? Who has jurisdiction over this matter? The church has primary jurisdiction. What should the first attempt be to resolve it? Private, personal conversation. That's the best thing to do. Okay, let me jump down to question number 6. Who has the responsibility to be the first person to go and seek reconciliation, Bob or Joe? Good. We gave a bunch of pastors this test, and some came back with Bob, and some came back with Joe. And I said, wrong, trick question. They should meet each other on the way, shouldn't they? When we sin, if I sin, God calls me to go and confess. And if I have offended or someone else or that other person who has something against me needs to come to me and seek reconciliation. I don't think there's ever a situation where the other person can just sit there and do nothing. We should be seeking reconciliation, whether we're the wrongdoer or the offended person, to confront, to restore, or to make right, to make restitution. So you guys got a good answer. That's great. Okay. What advice would you give to Bob before he goes to talk to Joe again? What would you say to him if Bob comes to you and you're talking with him? Okay. Let's try to get some understanding. You know, try and think this through. Is there something going on? Maybe it's harvest time. Has there been a death in the family? Try to generate some understanding. Pardon me? Good. Find out how much it would cost. Are there some financial difficulties in performing on the contract? See, a lot of this does come back to that one basic principle, do to others what you would have them do to you. If you made a commitment to something and some unforeseen events came up, I know I would appreciate some understanding and some compassion on the part of the other person. If that's what I want, that's what I want to do for them as well. So some of these things, you just put yourself in their shoes, you want that. What else might you advise Bob? Good. Okay, that's a good idea. Sometimes these situations are so volatile, maybe one person isn't very articulate, the other person is very, and they're afraid to go, and say, well, I'd be happy to go with you. I know this other person, and I'm sure that he'd be very happy to have me be there too. Okay, that's a possibility. Just tear it down yourself. In fact, that is the advice I gave to the pastor. When he was asking what to do and he thought this lawsuit was going to be filed the next day, and he said, I don't know what to do, these guys won't talk with me. Now obviously there need be a need to do some other things eventually, but the first thing that came to my mind was, why don't you call up the deacons and go out there and tear this thing down and get it done with? But here's the interesting turn in that situation. He did call the deacons, and they were going to go out there that afternoon to tear it down. One of the deacons was related to the fellow who bought the farm, so he called up his cousin and said, I just thought you'd like to know a bunch of deacons from church going out there and tear down that shed that you were supposed to tear down on so-and-so's land. He was out there about an hour later removing the shed when he found out someone else would have to do it. I think, and that's a good point, is to intervene and to take on someone else's responsibilities, is that going to shelter him from the consequences of his own decision? If you had time, I would prefer to counsel him and to help him to see that he should get out there and keep his word. But if you're in a crisis state like this, and it looks like it's going to suddenly precipitate into a lawsuit, and the whole church is being affected, that might be a good basis to say, hey, let's just get out there and do this, and then sit down and talk with him afterwards. So that's a good point. It's not always right to intervene, but there are times. A woman called me up one time and told me she was having a real problem with someone who she shared a duplex with, and when this woman's baby was sleeping, the other woman went in and out the back door, and her kids did, and the screen door kept slamming. And she said, it wakes my children. I've asked her many times not to do it. It's so problematic. She's looking at this big, complicated solution. What would you tell her? Yeah, get one of those little hydraulic closers from the door. There was one on there. It wasn't working. I said, go out and spend $2 and get one, put it in there, and solve it. And sometimes it doesn't take anything more than eliminating a source of aggravation, at least to get that irritation out of the way. And then I would say, then begin building a relationship with this neighbor. Have her over for tea sometime and talk with her, get to know her. But sometimes we need to get that aggravation out of the way in order to start dealing with those personal issues. Then the pastor needed to follow up and sit down with these guys and say, listen, did you realize what you almost did to this church? And this church was literally divided down the center aisle. All the people on one side sat here, the other side there. So I would definitely sit down and counsel these men and work with them. And I really don't know what happened toward the end of it, but ideally, if this many people had been affected by it, ultimately I think those men should have gotten up and made confession before the church for what they'd done. So yes, you want to go down to those root causes and deal with them, but sometimes you need to snip off the thorns before they hurt more people. This is the kind of advice and the kind of situation, again, that I would like to see flowing from the church. That when there's a conflict, people would think of turning to someone in the church, asking advice, get these kinds of answers to it, and think, boy, that's terrific. I presented this seminar in an earlier form about 8 years ago to a high school group in a church I was attending. And understandably, some of the kids just sort of sat there and, you know, they tolerated, listened to it, went in one ear and went out the other ear. But there were some kids that were just so intrigued by these concepts. They were fascinated. Now, one young man in particular who was, I think, is called and gifted as a peacemaker. And he was a senior in high school that year, and he took these principles to heart, began to work them out in his own life, especially with his parents, whom he had some estrangement from. And he went back to school and began to apply them with friends. And word got around, and I heard this from other kids, that he had a reputation in a large high school as being a peacemaker. And when people had problems with their parents, with a boyfriend or girlfriend or with a teacher, they began to seek him out and ask for his advice. The world is desperately looking for people who can give good advice in these situations. As Paul Tripp said earlier, or Dave Paulison said, we all are counselors to some degree. So these are situations that do come up every day in our lives, and we should be there to give this kind of advice, to be creative. Okay, let's go on to, we'll do one more here. Okay, what are some observations on these two letters, strengths and weaknesses? Okay, it's more understanding, isn't it? Very important. It gives them the benefit of the doubt. You're assuming the best about somebody until you have hard facts to show otherwise. That's so important. Good. People, again, going to this interest-based negotiation, people can't respond to your interests if they don't know what they are. And so explaining to them what your concerns are, some of your limitations, can be very helpful to people. What else might you just say about it? It is because the contract for deed is secured by the home. And I've seen situations where someone buys a home, starts remodeling, gets partway through it, and then leaves it, and the house is not saleable. Then they stop making payments. And the sellers get the property back, and it's so worthless, they have a hard time. They have to put money into it to finish the remodeling. So you do find out that there is a concern here. But what's the difference in how the second one approaches it, that particular issue? Yeah, the first one sort of implies, what are you doing with the house? It's sort of a little bit more suspicious and could be read to be accusatory. But the second one says, we affirm, we believe it's the best, and we just understand these things are happening. I spend a lot of my time reading letters that people draft like this. They'll be in a situation and a personal confrontation is not an option. So I say, well, why don't you write a letter and come back in a few days and drop it by and we'll talk about it. And so I'll go through it. And what I try to do is I put on my most critical glasses. I think if I was going to receive this, is there anything where I could read an insult or suspicion or mistrust into it? And I try to weed out words and phrases. And the first one, although it's not too strong, could be a little bit of an insinuation I'm doing something wrong. The second one specifically says, no, we know you're doing a good job. We appreciate it. So again, a little bit of gracious speech here, affirming somebody, saying what they do, and giving them the benefit of the doubt will generally evoke a proper response. I need to tell you the truth about these letters. I wrote the first letter. My wife wrote the second one. She actually critiqued my first letter. And I did it in a hurry. It was on a situation. And then I said, Corlette, would you look this over? And she said, I think it's a little bit too harsh. And so she talked about the change in the second one. We got the most beautiful letter back from these people. It was just marvelous. And he went into like a 6-page letter explaining the remodeling and how things are in the Middle East. And he just bent over backwards trying to be nice. They sent the checks. Every payment's been on time since then. And I think if I'd sent that first one, we might not have gotten such a positive response. Again, the principle here is that people generally treat us how we treat them. The idea of writing letters to people to deal with situations is so important. We live in a culture of constant interactions with strangers, and sometimes things have to be dealt with by means of correspondence. And to write a letter, to try to see how another person might read it, those are such important skills to develop, to teach your children, to practice yourself. I should just tell you quickly one situation I got into that demonstrated this so vividly to me. When I travel, I do a lot of conciliation while I travel someplace, meet with people. It's important to actually draft up settlement agreements right there on the spot. So someone donated to us a small notebook computer. And it's a little basic one. It's got what's called a 286 processor in it. I thought it was the greatest thing in the world when I got it. And of course, 3 months later, it's obsolete because there's things that are faster. Well, a friend of mine got the newer version that's 3 times faster. And he brought it by and we played with it for a while and I began to covet his new computer. And it's really a nice computer. But at the same time, the one I got, since it was the first version that came out, was having some problems. The screen went out a couple times, the hard disk drive failed once or twice, and every time that happened, I called the manufacturer, they sent out a new one, express mail, the next day we got all the information off. They lived up to all of their warranty obligations, so they fulfilled all their obligations to me. And they were very careful and very diligent in that. But partly because I wanted the newer computer, and partly because I was losing some confidence in this one I got, and I knew as they recycled them now, they weren't making that model anymore, so when I got a new one, it was really a recycled one. And I was just beginning to think, you know, I'm getting rejects here. And I was getting nervous traveling and not having something I could depend on. So finally one day, I just decided, I'm going to write a letter to this company, explain my concerns, and ask them if they'd give me a different computer. So I sat down and composed a letter to the president of the company, and I told them what we were using it for and how it had failed on me. And I said, I know you've lived up to all your obligations. You have no responsibility to do what I'm about to ask, but I'd appreciate it if you would consider it. I said, because of these things, I'd ask that you might consider exchanging my present computer for a newer one that's brand new, hasn't been recycled or reconditioned so that I know it's in good working shape. And I was going to put something in there about, of course, I'll pay the difference, but I thought, well, let me just see what he does with it. About 2 days, no, about 3 or 4 days later, I got a call from his secretary. This is one of the largest computer companies in the country. And this woman calls up and says, hello, I'm Susan. I'm a secretary for Mr. So-and-so. And we got the letter the other day and checked your file. And he's very concerned about what's happened. And he wanted me to call you and indicate we'd be happy to exchange your computer for another one. I thought, well, that's nice. And I had even suggested a certain model in my letter that I would like to have, the one that my friend got. And she said, so she went on and said all these things. I said, well, is this going to cost me something? She said, oh, no. And it's Dell Computers, or I guess I can mention that name. He said, Mr. Dell just wants to be sure that you're happy with what you bought from us. And I said, well, I'd be very happy if you would do that. So we're about to hang up, and she said, well, there is one thing he did want me to ask you. Okay, here it comes. She said, well, the one you asked for in your letter is a 20 megahertz processor, and we've actually come out with a brand new one since then. It's 25. It's quite a bit faster, and it's got a much larger hard drive. It's twice as big, and Mr. Dillon wanted to know if you'd prefer to have that one. And I said, how much is that going to cost me? Oh, nothing at all. Mr. Dell just wants to be sure that you're satisfied with this computer. I said, well, tell Mr. Dell I'd be very satisfied with that computer. And then she also said, there is one problem. These normally take about 3 months. We're way behind in our orders right now because it's a new model. But if you like that one, Mr. Dell asked me to personally see this one through production. I think I can get one to you in 10 days. I said, I'd appreciate that. She called me 3 times that 10-day period to tell me where it was in the manufacturing stage. And then I got that new computer. So as I go around the country, I talk to a lot of people about Dell computers. See, it was good sense on their part. It was a very wise approach in dealing with a client to make sure I was satisfied. Fact is, I've got 5 computers in my office from Dell computers, and I've recommended it to people. So there's some good business sense on their part. But as I looked at that letter, and I took 2 or 3 days to write it, and it was just tailored along the lines of the second letter here, they responded graciously. And I've seen that happen again and again, working with insurance companies on payments and defective merchandise. If you write a gracious letter and do it respectfully and ask instead of demand, generally you'll see people responding in a favorable way. So I would just encourage you, one of your jobs that the Lord may call you to in the months ahead might be an editor. If you've got a friend who's got a problem, say, hey, I'd like to help you with that. Why don't you write a letter sort of along these lines and then bring it to me and I'll go over with you and we try and really edit it down and see what we can do. Might be a way to really minister to people, be an editor. There's an older woman in Billings that does that for a lot of people. She's got a gracious gift of language, and so she spends a lot of time helping people. Okay, let's do one more problem here. We've got just a few minutes. Dick has come to you, and he's explained the situation. He's given you these facts, and he's saying, what do you think I ought to do? What would you do? That's exactly the right answer. Very good answer. Let me give you some of the information that other questions would bring out. We use this case for a role play. We have some hidden facts that people have to unearth, and here's some of the facts if you ask Dick the right questions you get. It's always fun watching this role play because you know what these facts are, and people usually don't ask these questions. Fact number one is that Wendy, this other woman that stayed on, did start her present position after you, after Dick, but she had previously worked for Homeward Bound as a secretary for 3 years and then went back to school for 2 years before returning to the organization in her present capacity as a counselor. So what does that say? That really, in a sense, she does have seniority. She's had more time invested there. At least there's a reasonable argument for that position. That could be a reasonable policy there. So that would diminish this fact or this allegation of favoritism. Secondly, is you have been somewhat careless. Dick has been somewhat careless in his record keeping, but he has made a sincere effort to improve since Julie confronted him. So there's some basis to a confrontation. Third, and this is a very significant one, Dick has been very negative around the workplace for the past year, grumbling and complaining and criticizing Julie behind her back. Fourth, 6 months ago, Dick got caught taking some company tools, a hand drill and a sander, home to do some personal work, which he knows is against a company policy, but he thought it only applied to large pieces of equipment like vehicles. He also knows that other employees took the same tools home and never got in trouble for it. And finally, 3 months ago, Dick was reprimanded for taking one of the boys for a ride on his motorcycle, which is against a company policy that he did not know about. Now, having that additional information, what are some things you might talk to Dick about and just try to help him think through? You bet, is to face up to the fact that there is some basis for these accusations. He's done some things wrong. He's not spotless in this case, and he needs to take responsibility for that. And that has to be a starting point in this, is to get the log out of his own eye. What other things might you point out to Dick or try to help him to see? That could be it. I mean, to help him realize that relationship has got some fundamental problems and requires some very, very major changes to make it work. I would still hope and pray that he might be able to redeem it, but sometimes people need to be realistic and say, this just may not be the best place for me. Anything else? What is something that Dick needs to appreciate that he apparently is not understanding about this situation? Okay, Julie's in charge. There's an authority there that he needs to respect. That's certainly true. The point that actually was significant when I talked to this man was the fact that, go ahead. Excellent point. When God tells us to submit to those above us. It says to submit, to work for them or serve them as though serving Christ himself, that he's the ultimate authority. But here was the thing that Dick did not appreciate until we began to talk about it, is that in these child care settings these days, the potential for liability, legal liability for those folks is so high. We've got a youth care facility in Billings. They've had some suicides out there. And the minute a kid is injured or commits suicide, bingo, you've got lawyers coming out of the woodwork bringing lawsuits. And the first thing they do is they get into all the records and find out if that place is spotlessly clean in its procedures, its counseling, its record keeping. Do you enforce your policies? And if they find situations where counselors have violated the rules and have not been reprimanded, have not been corrected, that's evidence they just add to their thing about, see, they're careless, they're sloppy, they don't care about the kids. And so that institution has a very legitimate and very significant interest in maintaining a safe environment for those children. If there are situations they just let slide by, later that can be used against them. And Dick just didn't appreciate. We talked for about an hour before he began to see that most of these institutions are getting paranoid. They're so concerned about being sued. And so his taking that person out on a motorcycle and just zipping down the street was a very serious infraction. He didn't think it was. He played it down. But he eventually began to realize it was a very serious infraction of a significant policy in that institution. Okay, realizing that, Dick comes to grips with that. What would you counsel Dick to do if he said, I just don't know what to do? Either through questioning and helping him to come to it, or you're just giving advice, what eventually would you want to lead him to do? Excellent point. To go back and, number one, get the log out of his own eye, confess the things he's done wrong and admit that they were inappropriate, and to ask your forgiveness. That's step one. And then secondly, as part of that process, he could say, Julie, I appreciate your listening to me and taking this time. I do care about this facility, and even though I'm not working here, I care about the kids and everything else. And if you would like me to, there's a couple things I would be willing to point out that I think might make it work better, and specifically on how you manage people that have affected our relationship that might be affecting others. Would you like me to share those things with you? So instead of just saying there's some things I need to tell you, is to say, you know, may I, and ask her. Most people in that situation will not be able to say, no, I don't want to hear about it. They will say, yeah, what is it? And so you can graciously confront in a situation and share some things about what's going on. Now, it depends on a lot on the relationship, whether you know if this person's a believer or not. Maybe there's such hostility and such suspicion here, you may not get very far with this at all. But in other cases, you might get a long ways down the road. We had a case very similar to this 3 years ago where a professional was fired, and he was going to bring a wrongful discharge case, but he went back to confess his wrongs. He spent a whole week writing out his confession. I mean, this fellow was very diligent. It was a 5-page confession. And he went in there, and he didn't read from it, but he had it with him. He highlighted a few things, and he just went through and listed item by item things he knew he had done wrong. And in his particular case, we felt that the contract had actually been breached substantially by the employer. There was no basis to have him fired. He'd done some things that contributed to some problems, but it was not a substantial breach of his contract. But he went in there anyway, decided not to enforce the contract, asked for forgiveness, and then asked if he could share with the owner of the business some observations and some constructive criticism. And the owner said, well, go ahead. And so then he began to read through and share some observations how this man was relating to his employees. He was very harsh, very suspicious, very critical, would not listen to them. And quite a few things were very hurtful. And about 3 or 4 minutes into this confrontation, the owner of the business started to cry. A man, a big, macho, tough man. And he started to cry, and the fellow who was confronting him stopped. He said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. And the owner said, no, you haven't hurt my feelings. You're the first person I can ever remember coming to me and talking to me to help me. And it turns out he was, in fact, having serious problems in his marriage. It was affecting how he was running his business or anything else. And he offered this man his job back because he'd found a friend, someone who wanted to be faithful, wanted to be loyal, and cared enough to offer constructive criticism. Now, that won't always happen. Sometimes people won't even give you the chance to do it. But again, it'll never happen if you don't try. And so he had an opportunity to minister to somebody. So going and offering constructive criticism can be very helpful. The other thing to realize, we had another firing case. We get a lot of employment disputes where people get fired or quit their jobs or something like that. And one of the cases, the employee finally came to conclusion that even though he would have had an opportunity and might have had some kind of a legal action in the case, it was a close call because he'd done things that contributed to his problems. And he decided not to bring any action. He did work things through the former employer. By that time, the employer had hired somebody else to fill his position. And the employer was willing to try to make a new spot. He wanted to try and make amends. But the employee thought about it for a day. He says, no, you know, the more I think about it, the more I can see that the God is working to move me on to something. And I probably never would have opened my eyes to that if I just stayed here. But I can see there's just a limit to how far I'm going to be able to go in this company with my present education. And now that I lost that job, it forced me to review things. I've applied for school. I'm going back to school. And I think God is moving me on to something different. So his confidence that God is sovereign and working even in those situations opened his thinking to see that maybe the Lord has something else in mind for me. So that even also helped to remove his anger, any residuary bitterness towards somebody. So having that perspective helped, yes. Well, that's an excellent point, getting some honest feedback. Now, here's something that comes up, and you get in some ticklish areas on these employment disputes. I don't know what the law is in the states you all come from, but in Montana, the laws on wrongful discharge are very confused. And when an employer fires somebody, they're normally very paranoid about being sued because there's been some lawsuits brought. They've changed the law, and there's not as many suits now, but there's still some paranoia. And so when someone is laid off in this situation, as Dick was, he doesn't know exactly why he's laid off. And that was one of his main concerns. He says, you know, it troubles me that I got fired, and I don't know if it's because I'm a bad worker or because of something else. And it was leaving him with a real sense of unease. And so he wanted to go back and talk with them. He called up, and they said, we won't talk with you. Because they were afraid that, and their lawyers told them, anything you say can eventually be used against you in a wrongful discharge action. So this information he really wanted, he couldn't get because he was a threat to the company. What would you advise him? You bet. He's got to somehow put them at ease. Now, I don't know exactly legally how binding that would be, although I think it would be because you're getting consideration. It's a contract, basically, and you would write out a paper saying that in consideration for your willingness to sit down with me and honestly tell me why I lost my job, I hereby agree and stipulate that I will not bring any action against this company as a result of anything you would say or my losing the job. And I believe if you signed that, I think that would be a legally binding contract. And so you could go in there, put them at their ease, and they would share some things. In this particular case, Dick did do that, went in there, found out some very helpful information. It wasn't all personal acrimony and antagonism from Julie. He had some significant problems in his work behavior. And by humbling himself and asking for that information, giving them security, he got that information, was able to go on and grow. He entered into a counseling relationship with an elder in his church, began to work on some of these problems. So that was a better way to work it through. So again, some of the creative ideas that we can come up with, advising other people, or perhaps even more than that we can apply in our own lives when we lose our jobs and we have these kinds of problems. So, well, there is one other question on this worksheet, but I think we need to call it a day. I'm sure all of you are ready to head on home. If you want to, work that one through yourself. It's one of the more complicated cases we have. There are some hidden facts in it. But I'll just tell you that one of the key facts in this particular case is there was an inheritance that involved a four-wheel drive Chevrolet Suburban. And one of the significant facts is that somebody else in this dispute owned a four-wheel drive Jeep. So keep that in mind as you work through that problem and see if you come up with a solution. Thank you so much for your time, and Lord bless you as you go out there to be peacemakers. See you.